Fred Film Radio, Festival de Cannes.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 67 Cannes Film Festival, and I'm joined by the great Jean Boorman, who's presenting Queen and Country at the Quinzaine des Réalisateurs Directeurs Fortnight. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
John, would you like to tell our listeners what the film is about, the story of the film?
Well, I made some years ago a film called Hope and Glory about my childhood in the London Blitz. And this film is 9 years later, when I was 18 and had to go in the army for 2 years. And so it's about being 18 and being brutalized by the army, about falling in love with the wrong girl, and making friendships, and really, I suppose, becoming a man.
Right. So, what made you want to sort of revisit the grounds that you had already visited with Hope and Glory, which is a great film, by the way?
Well, you see, at the time, in the 50s there, it was a rather dreary period. You know, it was a hangover after the war, and rationing was still on. And I was rather glad to kind of escape it and get into the much more salubrious 60s. But looking back at it in the recent years, I realized how important that period was, because you see in the film, the older soldiers, the regulars who've been in the war and were still hanging on to the glories of empire and the ideals and values of that time, of that previous time, and we, the young, could see that it was all over and that the empire was going to fall apart, and England was going to become a very different place. And so that generational divide is right at the heart of the film, so I wanted to say something about that. And of course, you know, one of the big reforms the Labour Party passed was the Education Act, which set up the secondary modern schools, and for the first time kids were taught music and art. And out of that came the 60s, came the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the art, and so it was a transforming time. And so I thought it would be good to revisit it, of course all the incidents in the film occurred, and the characters were all characters that I knew. And I'm hoping that since it's particularly the older characters must be, you know, I'm 81, so the older characters must be, you know, in their 90s or their 100 or something. So I hope they're all dead and they can't sue me.
Well, I mean,
they deserve to die, actually.
really yeah. That bad? Well, I guess some of them were look like real scumbags, to be honest. But yes, it's really interesting to notice that the key moment in the film is obviously the coronation of the Queen. And you can see from there on that there's going to be a change, even within the characters. Sexual liberation and sex is obviously like a theme that's, like, you know, tastefully underplayed, but it's there. There. Was that an important kind of theme as well, to show this rise of the youth culture and the changing times?
Yes, it was, you know, I mean, sexual frustration was one of the most vibrant forces in the at that time, particularly 18-year-olds.
Highlighted also by the frustration exhibited by some of the army characters. That might be it, isn't it?
And of course, and the other issue that I wanted to explore was that, of course, you know, wars are all fought by 18-year-old boys. George Bernard Shaw said the way to end wars is to pass a law that only men over 40 are allowed to fight. And he said that would be the end of wars, because and you were in the scene at the end of the film, when you come to the hospital where the wounded boys coming back from Korea and without their uniforms on, they look just like a bunch of children.
Yeah.
And it's very moving. That was a very moving thing for me at the time.
Right.
To see that.
Yeah, absolutely. In the sense of the narrative and the way the story is brought to the screen, it reminded me a lot of the classics. And of course, you, the lead character in the film, who I take it is supposed to be a version of you, makes reference to cinema all the time. So,
yeah.
Cinematic influences in this film were definitely could definitely be seen. Was that another? Were you paying tribute in a way to your passions?
Well, of course, I was. As so many of us were at that time, at that age, 18, you know, we were crazy about the movies, seeing them. And also that my family lived on the Thames at Shepperton, which is close to the film studio. Mm. And part of my childhood was always watching film units on location.
Yeah.
And which you see in the film.
Yes,
as well.
Course.
So it was somehow always part of my life. Mm. And when I was 17,
yeah.
I took part in at that time in BBC youth programs. They had these youth programs, I was the chairman of a kind of junior critics program, which went on every week, and as part of that, I suggested that I should do a series about technicians, you know, in film. And I went to all the film studios and interviewed the cameraman or the grip or the gaffer, and I learned a lot about film through that series.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was your film school, really, in a way.
It was. There were no film schools then, really, but I did. And then, of course, the other thing that was important to me was that when I was 18, the National Film Theatre opened in London.
Yes.
Yeah. And they showed all the classic silent films. And I haunted the place. I lived there. And so I was steeped in film, really.
Wow.
And eventually, you know, when I got out of the army, I eventually got a job as a trainee film editor.
Yeah.
And
it all started from there.
Yeah.
A wonderful career. And of course, you're back here in Cannes. You won Best Director twice here. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And you're back here with this excellent film. Now, another question I wanted to ask you, of course, is that the actors in the film, because they're portraying a big part of your life, how did you find them? How did you come across them? And how did you help them shape their performances?
Well, it was difficult to find a boy to play me, as it were.
Oh.
And I just interviewed lots of boys. And finally, Callum, who has no training as an actor, and this is his first film, and he plays the lead. It's a big thing. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but he's such a natural, and he relates to the camera so well. And it's very strange because he, you know, he constantly was saying to me, you know, what should I do here? What should I, you know, what did you do at the time? And I said to him, you know, you're not playing me, you're playing a character based on me, if you like. And I was always, oddly enough, always felt quite detached from it. I never felt. The only character was played by David Thewlis, who plays this monster, and he's so like him that every time he came on the set, I had this little freeze of fear, you know.
Mm.
It really got to me. But in other respects, not really. I was able, you know, the relationship between memory and imagination is a very mysterious one.
Yeah.
And I really don't understand it.
No?
Quite.
What does that conflict come from? That relationship between memory and imagination.
Well, because you know, when I was writing the script of Hope and Glory, when I finished it, I showed it to my mother and my older sister because they figured in it.
Yeah.
And I said, look, if there's anything in there that you don't like, I'll leave it. I'll change it. And they were both astonished because things that I felt I'd invented turned out to be true.
Right.
And they were couldn't understand or believe how I could have remembered them or witnessed them. And so the imagination, I think, is often more reliable than the memory.
All right.
And that if you start to invent, you are perhaps finding a deeper truth.
And it's a case where, like, cinema becomes more real than real life.
Well, the relationship between film and life is, of course, one of the themes
that
we explore.
Thank you very much, Sean. It's a wonderful film, and I was very happy to have seen it and happy to have talked to you. Thanks very much. This is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.